We're recording now. Welcome, everybody. This is the third lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, organized by the Numota Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Study Initiative at the University of Hamburg. And our topic today is women in medieval Buddhist and Jain monasticism. And it is my great pleasure to welcome Marie Jaisavi Stewart, who is going to kindly speak to us on this topic today. Marie Jaisavi Stewart is an assistant professor of religious studies at the University of South Carolina in the United States, where she teaches South Asian religions. She has a long-standing interest in the monastic traditions of South Asia, issues of gender, and the historical interrelationships among the Buddhist, Jain, and Hindu traditions. Her research has focused on the rhetorical uses of gendered representations of monks and nuns in early medieval Buddhist and Jain commentaries. Besides these topics, her academic interests include the place of the human body in religious discourse and practice, religion and ecology, and religion and medicine. She received her doctorate from Harvard University in 2011 and taught South Asian religions at Reed College in Portland, Oregon for 2 years before joining the faculty of USC. This much for introduction, and now I hand over to Mary. Need to switch on the mic. I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now?
No, it's working.
No, it's working.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Venerable Analaya, for that introduction, and welcome to everybody to this segment of the course. It's my pleasure to be here to talk about something that I've been working on and been interested in the last few years. And good afternoon to everyone in Europe. It is morning time here in the US. So as my title suggests, today I'll be talking about putting the Buddhist women's and monastic women's tradition in the context of the broader South Asian religious context, specifically its relationship to the Jain order for monastic women. And I suggest that these comparisons are instructive in that oftentimes the Buddhist and the Jain traditions, they have been looked at side by side in terms of their historical trajectories. There are many parallels as well as differences. But these two traditions were among the first. They were, as far as we know, the first currently existing traditions that created monastic institutions for women. And this happened in a cultural context of South Asia, which, as we know, was largely patriarchal. So the success of these women's monastic orders is somewhat remarkable, and it is worth looking at what kinds of moves did these two traditions make in order to, first of all, create these traditions, to accommodate them, what kinds of negotiations and tensions they had to work through over the centuries. And since I know that the majority of the participants in this course, I suspect, know more about Buddhism than Jainism, that tends to be the case, as well as virtually all of the other lecturers in this series will be speaking primarily about Buddhism, I thought as part of my lecture I would give some more background on the Jain tradition, just to give people some more context of what we are talking about, and familiarize them with some of the excuse me, aspects of the Jain tradition. But I would like to start with a passage that often gets cited about the Buddhist tradition whenever the questions of women's status, specifically nun's status, come up. And it is specifically this one. This is the version from the Pali Vinaya, but it has parallels in some of the other Vinayas as well. And this is a passage coming right after the segment of the text where the Buddha has declared that a nun, no matter how senior she is, has to pay respect to a monk, no matter how junior he is. So even if the nun has been ordained for 100 years, she must pay respect to a monk, even if he has been ordained on that very day. As many of you know, this is the passage that has been commented on both critically and apologetically over the years, especially in these recent debates and discussions on the legitimacy of reintroducing bhikshuni ordination. And in this passage, the Buddha justifies why it is, when Ananda is pleading, can we please change this rule, why it is that he thinks it cannot be changed. And he says, it is impossible, Ananda, it cannot come to pass that the Tathagata should allow greeting, standing up for, respectful salutation, and the performance of proper duties towards women by monks. In other words, monks should not have to do this respectful greeting towards nuns. Ananda, even the followers of other sects whose conduct is poorly guarded, they will not carry out greeting, standing up for, respectful salutation, and the performance of proper duties towards women. How then could the Tathagata allow this, essentially? So what's remarkable here is that at the very moment when we first hear the Buddha articulate the reasons why, in this case, there's a clearly an establishment and reinforcement of the hierarchy, gendered hierarchy in the monastic order, of placing nuns in subordination to monks. His justification for that is that other traditions are doing that too. Which tells us two things. First of all, that these monastic traditions in South Asia were looking to each other when it came to how do we manage and negotiate the situation, the existence of nuns and women in our orders. They were kind of looking at, well, how are other communities doing this? And seem to have been learning from that. And that then tells us that it doesn't necessarily matter. We don't necessarily need to know which followers of other sects exactly the Buddha had in mind. We do know that at this time there was a community called the Ajivikas who did have nuns among their community. They have since died out, and we have almost no way of knowing what rules exactly they had. Did they have such a rule about against monks greeting nuns and nuns having to greet monks? We don't know. We do know that at the time there was another religious tradition that had an order of nuns, and that was the Jain tradition. And in fact, we do find in a Jain text, although centuries later, since it is we don't have accurately datable Jain texts from these early layers, from these early centuries. But we do have an instance from roughly 4th, 5th century CE from a text called Upadeshamala, where the wording is almost exactly the same as in the Buddhist cases. Even if a nun were initiated for 100 years and a monk were initiated just this day, he is still worthy of being worshipped by her through such acts of respect as going forward in reverential greeting, salutation, and bowing down. Again, what do we make of this? This could, of course, be something that the Jains adopted later on, perhaps following the Buddhists. Maybe this was a practice that was, had been observed for centuries before Dharmadasa Gani wrote this text. Again, to me, it's not sort of beside the point to whether the Buddha is specifically referring to the Jain groups. To me, it's interesting that the justification for retaining this one really fundamental instance of gender inequality is that, look, other sects are doing that too, which tells us that to the Buddha, he felt like he should care about it. In other words, these traditions were looking to each other in trying to establish what is the appropriate status for the women in our community. And that tells us that it was an issue where they had to consider, how are we being perceived? What is our public image? And how does having women in our midst affect that? So what I'm suggesting in the course of this talk is that how these traditions, in this case Buddhist and Jain monastic traditions, how they handled and treated their women, how they organized the relationships between men and women in the order, these were crucial for their public image. So before I continue further, I'd like to, as I said earlier, now take some time to introduce more thoroughly the Jain monastic order, and specifically the Jain nuns order, since most participants won't be as familiar with it as they are with Buddhism. Jainism is an ancient Indian tradition, historically older than Buddhism, although its beginnings are exactly hard to date. But certainly having a very strong renunciant focus, in some ways being known for, in terms of the conduct of monks and nuns, even more strict in terms of some of the ascetic observances. Historically, there's been sometimes confusion in the eyes of outsiders. They have often tended to lump Jains and Buddhists together. For example, the 16th century Saint Vallabha was speaking of Jains as Bautas, as followers of the Buddha. And similarly, in the 19th century, Western interpreters were suggesting that perhaps Jainism was just an offshoot of Buddhism. That has since been proven not to be the case. But they have tended to have these parallel trajectories, and yet their faiths historically have been quite different. Buddhism spread to other parts of Asia and virtually disappeared in South Asia for a long period of time. Jainism never really spread far outside of the boundaries of South Asia. It remained specifically an Indian tradition. But unlike Buddhism, has survived there to this very day, and now remains a small religious minority of about roughly 4 million people in contemporary South Asia. So if you look at especially contemporary sort of secondary literature on the subject of Jainism and women's position in Jainism, you will sometimes find the idea articulated that Jainism, specifically in contrast to Buddhism, has been more accommodating, having less gender bias against women. And there are a few justifications for this. First of all, as many of you know by now, or will certainly know by the end of this course, there are these narratives of the Buddha's reluctance to allowing women to go forth in his order. You find it in almost all of the Vinayas. The Jains often say, we don't have such records of Mahavira, their Tirthankara, their religious leader, opposing women's ordination. Therefore, surely the Jain text has been more accommodating of nuns. Another issue is the historical references to the number of male and female renunciants in the communities of the Jain Tirthankaras. So the Jainism celebrates and traces itself back to a total of 24 Tirthankaras, individuals who attained spiritual deliverance and omniscience and then went on to teach others. So all of these 24 Tirthankaras are said to have both nuns and lay women among their followers. And what's striking about these numbers is that there are always at least twice and often more times more nuns than monks among the entourage of these Tirthankaras. So, for example, the first Tirthankara, the mythical Rishabha, is said to have had 84,000 monks and 300,000 nuns among his followers. I'm skipping a number of them, jumping to the 23rd, Tirthankara Parashva, who was also a historical person predating the Buddha, who had 16,000 monks, 38,000 nuns. And finally, Mahavira, the most recent and last Tirthankara, who is a senior contemporary of the Buddha, we believe, had 14,000 monks versus 36,000 nuns. So these numbers can hardly be taken literally, but it probably tells us something that the nuns always outnumber the monks. And it's never really explained why there are so many more nuns. What is that indicative of? But you will find modern Jain authors sometimes articulating the idea that this shows us that the Jain tradition was very welcoming of nuns and did not place such qualifications as the Buddhist order did. And thirdly, at least in the face of it, the Jain tradition, unlike the Buddhist tradition, does not have this notorious set of age rules that the Buddhist tradition knows as the Guru Dharmas, which specifically are set aside and kind of framed as establishing the status of women as institutionally subordinate to that of men in the order. We don't find a set of such age rules in the Jain tradition. However, stressing that, of course, allied to the fact that if you look closely at the actual monastic rules for Jain monks and nuns, there are disparities between how the rules are articulated for monks and nuns, and many of them are, in fact, gender-specific, making them more strict for nuns. So I will say more about that in a moment. But technically, we don't have a celebrated list or notorious list of eight Guru Dharmas. So it may appear at first glance, at least, and this is something we do find in modern secondary literature at times, the idea that Jainism has had a more positive stance towards women in the order than the Buddhists. But as I said, we need to examine this further. Briefly, the Indic terms for Jain mendicants, we find terms such as Nigantha, Niganthi, Prakritized forms of the Sanskrit Nirgrantha, Nirgranthi, referring to somebody who's without bounds, who's cut off all their bondages. Muni and Sadhvi are the masculine and feminine, respectively, terms we find used more commonly today, and there are others as well. But I want to bring this up because in my talk today and in my work otherwise, you'll find me speaking of Jain monks and nuns. And I want to mention that technically to speak of Jain monasticism is a little bit problematic. If by monasticism we mean established institutions that have some kind of physical location, such as buildings. We know that both Buddhists and Jains in the beginning had a very itinerant ideal of wandering from place to place, not having home, not having possessions. It seems that the Jains held on to this ideal more strictly than the Buddhists did and resisted the idea of permanent lodgings. So if by monasticism we mean permanent lodgings, then it's not an ideal term for the Jains. They really, apart from brief stays or stays during the rainy retreat, they tended to want to be traveling from place to place all the time. And this continues to the present day. So it may be more accurate to speak of male and female mendicants, male and female ascetics, But for simplicity, to allow the comparison to Buddhism, I tend to speak of monks and nuns. Just wanted to make that clear. Lastly, the scriptural language of the Jains is Prakrit, another form of Middle Indic, like the Pali language. There are different sort of dialects of Prakrit that they have used in composing their texts. For example, the Jain canon is composed in a Prakrit called Ardhamagadhi. Some of the commentaries, the later texts that I talk about today, are written in Maharashtri Prakrit. An important historical development in the Jain tradition has been the division into two main subsects, the Digambaras, or the sky-clad, and Shvetambaras, the white-clad, the ones in white robes. And this has been depicted as a dramatic split, but historical evidence suggests it was more of a gradual digression towards two different traditions for these communities. And rather than a really abrupt doctrinal split, many of the issues that the Digambaras and Shvetambaras disagreed on, it was a lot about practice, and most fundamentally about the decision to wear clothing or not. So both traditions agree that Mahavira and his community of monks practice ascetic nudity, and Digambaras insist we should hold on to this practice. So even today, fully initiated Digambara monks do not wear clothing. Shvetambara monks and nuns do wear white clothing, and they say, this is what we have to do nowadays. So you make this, they are more moderate in this respect. Another set of disagreements revolves interestingly around the spiritual status of women. The Shvetambara tradition tends to say that even for female, spiritual liberation is possible without being reborn in a male body, whereas the Digambara insist women have to be reborn in a male body in order to be liberated. And then lastly, the disagreements are around whether the Kevalin, the spiritually omniscient being, is still hungry and needs to sustain his body. And according to Digambaras, they don't. According to Shvetambaras, they do. Because of these disagreements, some related to practice, some related to doctrine, by the mid-5th century or so, when the Shvetambaras gathered at the Council of Vallabhi to compile their canon, the Digambaras were not present at that time, and since then they have rejected the authority of Shvetambara's scriptures. And that is those are the two main groups in Jainism. For the purposes of today, I will be primarily focusing on Shvetambara Jains, simply because that happens to be the tradition that I have worked on and know better. And secondly, we don't really have very good early sources on Digambara Jain nuns. There are Digambara Jain nuns, but we don't know that much about their practices historically. Okay, so what are the textual sources? How do we know about what practices Jain nuns had to observe? Our primary set of textual sources for this is a set of texts known as the Cheda Sutras. These are six texts in the Shvetambara Jain canon, and they explain the regulations that monks and nuns have to observe in their daily life. Unlike in Buddhism, we don't find in these texts separate sections for the nuns' rules, such as the Bhikshuni Vibhanga or Bhikshuni Pratimoksha Sutra in the Buddhist Vinayas, which lay out, okay, here are all the rules for nuns specifically, and in which we often find more rules for nuns than for monks. In the Jain case, the rules for nuns are intertwined with those for monks. So sometimes they are phrased for both genders. A monk or a nun is not allowed to do X. Sometimes you will find the rules alternating. So a monk is allowed to do this, a nun is not allowed to do this, and so forth. And in some cases, specifically, we do find that certain things are allowed for monks, but not for nuns. Although there are some cases where it is simply a matter of switching the gender. So, for example, monks must not stay in the same lodging with women, whereas nuns may not stay in the same lodging with men. So it is simply more gender-specific. But we do find numerous rules formulated exclusively for nuns, and many of them do not have corresponding rules for monks. So we do find actually more rules, more restrictions in general for nuns. The Cheto Sutras themselves, they are not very elaborate texts. They tend to be fairly terse, simply lists of rules, not a lot of interpretation or elaboration. And for detailed explanations and narratives and discussions of what to do when it is simply not possible to follow the rule, when you have to make an exception, we have to turn to later post-canonical commentarial texts that started to be composed around the 6th century of the Common Era and then continued through the medieval ages and to some degree to the modern day as well. And those are texts that I'll be discussing today. Briefly, I want to mention the Jains have what they call the five great vows, which are the most fundamental rules for monastics, such as no killing, no lying, no stealing, no sexual activity, and no possessions. And in the case of one Jain author that I'll go on to discuss later today, he was suggesting that, again, the same rhetoric that the Jain tradition is more equal, because look, the five great vows are the same for men and women. We don't have a special sixth great vow for the nuns. So therefore, not monks and nuns are treated equally. Again, that is true. But yet, if we look at the more specific, more detailed list of rules in the Cheto Sutras and their commentaries, we do find that, as I mentioned before, there are these gender inequalities and specific ways of addressing the two different genders. So again, it's not exactly the case. We find equality in the Jain sources. Okay, let's move forward. I want to briefly discuss then the issue of textual sources before we focus on some more specific issues and the question of how to read these sources. So my focus today, unlike some of the other talks, is on what we call the medieval, or in my case, early medieval period of Indian history. So roughly from the post-Gupta era, starting in the 5th century or so, when the very famous and influential Gupta Empire that covered most of North India collapsed. And in the following centuries, we saw many smaller kingdoms vying for power, but not any big empire. So what were the situations for nuns in the Buddhist and Jain orders during these centuries? What can we know about them? This is after the composition of canonical texts in both traditions. This is before we come to the modern or early modern period, when we have some more sources. So what can we know about the situation for nuns during these centuries? There are some inscriptions, really not that many for Jain nuns. I believe Dr. Alice Collette will be speaking later in the course on Buddhist inscriptions, references to women in Buddhist inscriptions, so I will not be spending time on that, just mentioning a couple of inscriptions that we have found to support the historical existence of Jain nuns, such as the 7th century one, from Gujarat, mentioning a sadhvi who was student of another, Vamhatra, of a senior nun. Famously, the life story of the 8th century Jain scholar Haribhadra makes reference to a Jain nun whom he found extremely impressive, Yakini Mahattara. And this nun so impressed him that he, in fact, converted to Jainism because of her. So there we have another glimpse of historical reference to a nun. Then, beginning in the 9th century, we find some references to nuns being involved in manuscript production. Not necessarily as authors or composers, but they were collaborating with the scribes or the composers of these texts. In general, when we're researching women during these centuries, what we call early medieval India, what are the available sources? Again, you can look at inscriptions. Even though the most robust bodies of inscriptions tend to come from an earlier period, in case of Buddhism at least, we do find some references that tell us here there were nuns. So that's one avenue. Then in the so-called, you may call it courtly or secular literature composed primarily in Sanskrit in courtly circles. So these are literary texts, and they are narratives, dramas, in some cases poetry. We do find some discussions, mostly in the form of fairly caricatured depictions in these texts. So many of them tend to be humorous, satirical dramas, and they make fun of the monk who breaks the rules or the nun who is supposed to be celibate, but gives in and is seduced by men. And there the idea is to make fun of the weakness of human beings. So we find these representations of monastic, members of monastic orders. How would we read sources such as this? What do they tell us about actual historical members of monastic orders at this time? That's a question. And then thirdly, a really robust body of sources that has been actually overlooked historically are monastic commentaries. These are commentarial texts explaining the earlier canonical rules from the 5th century, 6th century, 7th century and onwards. And what they do is they give us a glimpse of at this time, how were monastic authors and leaders and ideologues, how were they working out what the application of these rules should be for their time? Times were constantly changing. They were experiencing pressures of all kinds. And they had to work out, how do we apply these ancient rules, which we uphold as important? How do we apply them when life gets complicated and it's not an ideal setup? What if there's famine or war or we get attacked by a king who's angry towards us? So these give us really illuminating glimpses of living monastic traditions, constantly interpreting, negotiating how to live this life. On the Buddhist side, we find the very famous Buddhaghosa, writing in Pali, the Samantabhasadika, his commentary on the Pali Vinaya. So there he has some discussions more specifically on the nuns' rules. My focus has been on the Sanskrit and more northern tradition of Gunaprabha, who is said to have been a Mulasarvastivadin, a Buddhist Vinaya scholar, highly respected and well-known. He's mentioned, for example, by the 7th century Chinese Buddhist pilgrims coming to India. And a short monastic manual called Vinaya Sutra is attributed to him early on. And very soon thereafter, an auto commentary where he expounds and expands on this Vinaya Sutra. On the Jain side, we find commentaries on these Cheda Sutras that I mentioned, that are the monastic rules, the very brief monastic rules. And among these, I'd like to mention the, for example, Brihatkalpapashya by a monastic scholar named Sangadasa, who is dated to 6th or 7th century. Nishita Bhashya, Nishita Churni, Avyavahara Bhashya. These are among the texts that I'll be drawing on in my discussion today. So of all these sources, again, we want to ask the question, how do we read these texts? And I would specifically like to draw attention to the context of their authorship. What is the nature of these sources in terms of genre, in terms of the audiences that the authors were imagining or intending? What were their rhetorical aims? And whether it's courtly drama making fun of imperfect monastics, or whether it's these monastic commentaries, virtually all of our existing sources from pre-modern South Asia are composed, redacted, and transmitted by men. So when they speak of women in general, or nuns more specifically, it's usually speaking of, oh, them, as opposed to us, those nuns, those women. So they bring in, these authors bring in their particular stance and approach. And often, in the case of monastic texts, these monastic commentaries I'm speaking of, let's remember they're authored primarily by fairly elite monastic leaders, learned monastic leaders, who also were celibate men. And in their writings, we find this sense, oftentimes almost a paranoia, about the female body and the threat that that posed to these monks who were committed to their celibate lives and have to stay focused on that. So again, what they then have to say about women, whether women in general or nuns in their order, have to be seen through that lens as well, because it is blatantly obvious that their own practice of celibacy and having to view women as this threat from the outside colored their perceptions of nuns in their communities as well. And again, as far as these courtly satirical dramas are concerned, their main point, the author's main point, was not to, oh, let's give these 21st century textual scholars a really accurate representation of what female or male renunciants were like during our time. No, that was not their point. Their attempt was to entertain the audiences of their time. And we know that it's always funny when somebody is, appearing to be very reverent and worthy of respect, or a religious leader, and then turns out to be a hypocrite. So they were making fun of this tendency. Again, we cannot read them as historical, transparent documents in any way. You have to keep this, keep it in mind that again there is this rhetorical aim to entertain, poke fun at, they're not that useful, except perhaps to tell us how the courtly communities, what they thought of or were trying to display these religious communities as. Okay, let us now, since time is going fast, let's now turn to some of the more specific shared issues for the Buddhist and Jain orders for nuns. Because as we look at these two traditions again, the earliest traditions we know of that still exist that had monastic orders for women, there are remarkable parallels in what seem to have been the driving concerns as they tried to articulate the place of nuns in the monastic order. And I'll highlight about six of them and then talk about what does this mean for us? How do we interpret this? First, this is the issue that I started with, and this is the organization and authority within the monastic order. And just starting with the discretion of seniority in greeting. As I mentioned in the beginning, we have from the Buddhist side texts articulating, saying that nuns should reverentially greet monks, not vice versa. We find the same instance in Jain texts as well. So that is deliberately showing, displaying, and demonstrating to the outside communities, as well as to one's own community, that the hierarchy is females below males. As I also mentioned, there are no specific set of guru dharmas or eight heavy rules for Jain nuns, but many of the same principles are scattered throughout their rules, in fact. So, for example, the idea that nuns cannot spend long periods of time without some male supervision. Monks have to be in the same area, so the nuns cannot be independent. In many cases, we find also nuns having to confess their faults to monks, not vice versa, and so forth. And then the issue of seats, I think, is illustrative, because, again, that's a visible, demonstrable display of authority. Who gets to sit on the nice seat? For Buddhist nuns, in this Vinaya Sutra Oda commentary by Kunabrabha, it is specifically stated they must immediately arise from their seats when they see a monk. Again, placing them in a certain order of hierarchy. Similarly, Jain texts mention that, first of all, nuns, when they're being taught, when they receive instruction, they must be standing up while monks are allowed to sit down. And getting special seats was an honor reserved only for monks. So, for example, according to one story, when monks, some special visiting monks came to visit a group of nuns, they had to run around looking for nice seats for them to sit on while they themselves sat on the ground. And interestingly, here we have some art historical evidence that supports this. On this slide, we have an illustration. This is from the Ellora Caves in India, a relief dated to roughly the 10th century CE. This is from one of the Jain caves in Ellora. And on the left, we see some monks seated on the left from the naked Tirthankara figure. On his right is a group of nuns. And my friend and colleague, Lisa Owen, who's an art historian, has examined these reliefs, suggesting that it does look like here the monks are seated on something like seats or cushions, whereas the nuns appear to be sitting on the ground. So that's an interesting parallel between the texts and an art historical evidence that seats were something that were reserved for monks. Again, something that the surrounding lay community would see, they are sort of placing, in terms of their hierarchy, the nuns have a lesser status. And that seems to have been important for these communities. I'll say a little bit more about that in a moment. Secondly, we find the idea that monks have to play the role of guardians or protectors of nuns. We see this through and through in the ideal of the eight guru dharmas in the Buddhist tradition. The idea that is inappropriate, as here Gunabrabha says in his Vinaya Sutra commentary, it is inappropriate to stay in a place where there is no refuge. And by refuge, he means male guardians or protectors who can take care of them. The Indic, the Sanskrit term, the verb rakshati, to protect, it has these connotations of both to protect, in the sense of protecting from harm, to guard somebody, but also at the same time to control and to place boundaries around something, because presumably that thing cannot take care of itself. So that is the idea between this guardianship. It is both protecting as well as controlling. In the Jain case, we find very clearly articulated sense that since nuns are no longer with their families, they can no longer be guarded by the male family members as they should be. It is now the task of their monastic elders, specifically the male monastic elders, to guard them, to look after them, and to control them. Here, in this quote from the Jain Vyavahara Bhashya, And we find a really striking parallel with the very famous law code of Manu, authored in Sanskrit from the Hindu Brahminical tradition. The Jain version of this says, when a woman is born, her parents guard her when she's given. That means when she's married, her mother, father, in-laws and husband. And when widowed, when she's widowed, her father, brother and son guard her. And then, interestingly, the nun is also guarded by the teacher, by the male group leader and the female group leader. So there's a direct parallel here between perhaps one of the most infamous quotes from the law code of Manu, that a girl's father guards her in her girlhood, her husband guards her when she's married, and in her old age, when her husband has passed away, presumably, her sons guard her. A woman is not qualified to act independently. So there's no question to me that the Jains have this, not this particular Manu quote, but the same principle in mind when formulating this idea. And then translating it into what does this mean in the monastic context, since women have left their families and their male family members. Let's place monastic authorities from the same community instead of these three. So we'll have the teacher, that means the male, the head teacher of the community who was always a man, the male group leader, and then thirdly, a female elder as the third guardian. The Jain texts say that a nun is triply held by the hand by these three authorities. Again, the idea being a woman is never fit to act independently. So monks are placed in this position of guardians. Thirdly, regarding ordination, in both traditions, again, another parallel we find is that it tends to be more difficult for nuns to receive ordination. There are more obstacles placed. Whereas in the Jain tradition, there are 18 different causes that would prevent you from being eligible to ordain, but there are 20 for women. The two extra ones being pregnant and having a young child to support. Some texts do say that men can ordain without permission of family members, but women need their permission. And here's an interesting statement from the Achara Dinakara by Vardhamana Suri, fairly explicitly stating that men are not dependent on others, but women are dependent on others. And that is why that it's an explicit statement about that there's fundamentally something about women that makes them unable to act independently. So they need the permission of their family members. And men do not necessarily, although other Jain texts say men should also get the permission of their parents. Similarly, in the Buddhist case, if you ordain a woman without getting the permission of her master, these are the words of Guna Prabha again in the Vinaya Sutra. So the Sanskrit word swami means master, meaning husband in this case. And Guna Prabha adds, a husband is troubled if his wife gets ordained without permission, while there is not so much trouble if one ordains the husband, as he has simply abandoned his wife. So that tells us a woman, if she leaves her husband to go to a monastic order, that is still, she remains his wife. Whereas if the husband goes, that constitutes his abandonment of his wife, and now he's free to go. On a similar passage, the Sanskrit Bhikshuni Vinaya of the Mahasanghika Lokottaravadins explains that for an unmarried girl, these guardians who have to give the permission would be her parents. For a married woman, it is the in-laws and the husband. So again, differences in ordination, where we find striking parallels between Buddhists and Jains. The issue of lodgings was an enormous one to tackle. The Jain text is particularly interested in defining, okay, what is the kind of safe lodgings, the safe housing for nuns? And it is rather obsessed with the idea of creating safe enclosure with thick walls, a door that can be bolted or locked. It should be, as this quote shows, it should be near the host, the layperson who is providing the monastics with this residence. It should be close to women or widows, so elderly women who won't be perhaps who will be sort of reliable in the community, who may be keeping an eye on the nuns and so forth. Not too close to the neighbors and not too far. The Buddhist and Jain texts both tend to agree. The nuns should not live far away in the wilderness, in the forest, but they should also not live in the thick of hustle and bustle of the city. So it should not be at the crossroads, but still inside a town. As we find in this quote from the Buddhist commentary, a nunnery should be constructed inside a town. She should not stand at its door. This is a typical example of the rather very brief and exact language of Gunaprabha's Buddhist commentary. And he tends to, what he does a lot is explain the specific terms of what he's just said. It's in this sentence means the nunneries. She should not stand at the nunnery's door, nor should she stand at a viewing window. And by viewing window, he means not only a window, but one through which everything outside is visible. The nunnery should not be built at a crossroads, and she should not stand with or sit there without an outer garment. So here the concern for the Buddhist seems to be more with the visibility of nuns. She should not be at a central location where there'd like to be a lot of merchants, perhaps prostitutes, people who are not that pure-minded, so she should be somewhat guarded, stay indoors, and not stand at a door or windows. So in both traditions, there's emphasis on the lodgings being safe, and the nuns acting in ways that they don't seem to be wanting to be on display or attract attention to themselves. And related to this, just as we want thick, solid walls around the nuns' bodies, similarly we want modest monastic robes that cover their bodies in a culturally appropriate ways. And here the Jains have a lot more to say than the Buddhists, perhaps because, as I mentioned earlier, the historical rift between Shvetambara and Digambara monastics, Jains, focus so much on the issue of clothing that Shvetambara monastic leaders were kind of accustomed to discussing the topic of monastic robes and explaining why they are important for monastic or mendicant virtue. So when it comes to the question of how many robes should a nun wear, they find that they have a lot to say about that. And in fact, the difference in the Jain tradition is rather striking. A Jain monk owns only 3 pieces of clothing, so different rectangular pieces of clothing that they wrap around their bodies in different ways. During this medieval era, the complete outfit of a nun included those 3 plus 11 additional items. So to the complete wardrobe would consist of 14 pieces of clothing. And when this is described, it turns out to be a fairly elaborate way of putting on all these 14 items, including a menstrual pad, underpants, waist cover, short petticoat, inner and outer skirts, cover for the breast, left shoulder cover, right shoulder cover, the cloak, and the wind cover. And the idea is really for her to be all wrapped up like a plantain in its sheath or something like that. And we find illustrative narratives of people who are trying to cause trouble for the nuns and are trying to take off their clothes, and they cannot because they are so tightly wrapped up. So that is what constitutes a virtuous nun, according to these Jain commentaries. In fact, quote, when she's well covered by the waist cover and the long skirt, she's protected down to her feet. And then cultured people will agree to meet nuns if they move in groups of 3 and make noise, meaning if they're not just solitarily wandering or being quietly sneaking out, in which case, who knows what they're up to. But if a nun wears only 1 cloth, she will quickly come to ruin. So again, by wearing appropriate, perhaps even over-the-top, excessive clothing, by doing so, nuns indicate their willingness to be, to demonstrate their virtue and the fact that they are different from lay women who are sexually active and available. They're different from courtesans who deliberately display their bodies. In contrast, the Buddhists have less to say about the specifics of these outfits. They simply say, for nuns, we have 5 robes, so the same 3 robes as a monk, plus then in addition, because of the physical difference of men and women, additionally a breast cover and an undershirt that the nuns also have to wear. But at least in the text of Gunabrabha, the Buddhist commentator, that is virtually all that he has to say about it. So certainly not 14 items, and he seems to not be as obsessed about that. So much then for clothing. And then finally, we do find some restrictions regarding various ascetic or monastic practices, such as meditation, such that it was perceived that because of their femaleness, because of their gender, nuns are either not capable of or are not suited for, are not fit for certain ascetic practices. In case of Jain nuns, the Jains would traditionally have certain ascetic postures that they would practice, such as standing still for a prescribed amount of time, or these other kinds of positions, sitting down, squatting, sit in the hero posture, sitting like a stick, bent like a mango. These sound like descriptions of some yoga postures. So nuns, according to this canonical text, are not allowed to practice them. And in his commentary, when Sanghadasa explains why not, he says, only the kind of ascetic practice which does not violate the other vows is allowed. Because if seeing a nun in a posture of ascetic practice, someone, meaning an ill-intended male, might pursue her even if she is unwilling. That is why undertaking them as a vow is prohibited. What he means by this is, if you undertake a vow, I will not move from this position during this prescribed period of time, then you cannot escape if an unknown male accosts you and assaults you, because you have to keep your vow, right? So that is the main reason, again, when he says you cannot practice this kind of ascetic practice if, in observing it, your other vow, that of celibacy, gets compromised. So again, the overriding concern for these Jain monastic authors is that of celibacy and protecting the nuns' physical and sexual integrity, even to the extent that therefore they cannot observe these practices, which for monks seem to have been seen as spiritually efficacious. In the Buddhist case, we find discussions starting in the Vinayas, as well as this is the Vinaya Sutra manual of Gunabrabha. Again, there are specifications for how and where they can meditate. They cannot meditate in a house with open doors, possibly with a similar fear as the Jain commentator had, that somebody could come and harm them or assault them, even if they have a companion. And then, in terms of postures, instead of the cross-legged posture, the nuns can adopt the half-cross-legged posture, which is something that we see in certain contemporary Buddhist countries of Southeast Asia, for example. The nuns are seated differently from the monks. Here, the concern was, again, with the physical integrity of the nuns' bodies. Gunabrabha goes on to describe, and this is also something we find in the Pali Vinaya, the fear that some creature such as an insect or a snake might enter the genitals of the nuns. So therefore one ankle is kept as protection, therefore only the half cross-legged posture. Okay. So having discussed these few instances where we find a lot of parallels, some differences, but mostly parallels between how the Buddhist and Jain authors were handling the presence of female renunciants in their orders, what are some of the justifications for the inferior institutional status, having more rules and greater restrictions, and imposing and insisting on the monks' control over the nuns? I'd like to come back to the point that I started with, that in Indian religious traditions, which was the context for them was a predominantly patriarchal culture. Having women in a monastic community and what status was accorded to them and how they behaved was crucial for the reputation of the monastic community as a whole. And therefore, these issues, you know, how they, what status we give them, how they conduct themselves, were matters of concern for the monastic leaders, for the authors of these texts, because they sensed this will have an impact on our public image as a whole. As you may recall from the very first quote that I read, the Buddha is saying, oh, let's look at how these other communities are doing it. That tells us that it was a matter in which people were comparing themselves to each other and keeping an eye on what are the practices they are doing around their female renunciants. And so there's this awareness of being kind of the objects of other people's glances. We are being observed in this regard, therefore we have to do this in a certain way because it's the predominant culture. So in their discussions of why these special rules, we find my first three bullet points on this slide are ones that we find the texts themselves explicitly articulating. Both Buddhist and Jain authors of the early medieval era often repeat the perception that women need more rules because they are more fickle, less stable, both emotionally, physically, even intellectually. They need more rules because they have a tendency to be more proud, more arrogant, and more greedy. And in fact, they are more dominated by their senses. So our Jain author gives a lot of nice images, not nice, illustrative metaphors of what a woman is like. She's sort of fleeting. She's like a boat that hasn't been tied to the bank of the river, just floating this way. Or she's like a creeper climbing up a tree, which is lacking the support. So she's wavering in the wind. So whatever external impulses come, she's thrown this way and that by them. The idea, again, being if a woman is sexually pursued or harassed, she cannot resist because she doesn't have that independence and agency. She will just be swayed this way and that. So this was a very common, very strong gendered stereotype in the eyes of these men who wrote the text. That is one reason why women simply need more rules, more restrictions. Secondly, and related to this, is the perception that a woman outside of her home, outside of her family compound and the protection of fathers, husbands, and sons, is an object of sexual pursuit of others. That such women are in danger. And it is hard for us to estimate how much of this is a reality. Was pre-modern India really that dangerous for women, such that a woman could not leave her home without being in danger of being raped? It's really hard for us to assess at this point. What we do know is that certainly the male authors who are leaders of these communities felt that that was the case. So therefore, again, nuns need to be more confined. They need male guardians who will publicly be visible around them and show these are not just women who can be pursued easily. And related to this, then, is the, again, possibly perception rather than the reality, that the nuns would be associated with or confused with prostitutes and matchmakers, who were women who could roam about freely in Indian society, it seems. So by determining, well, our nuns are not like this, therefore they cannot move around this way and that, they have to observe these very strict rules. Both Buddhist and Jain communities were making an effort to delineate and demarcate their nuns as different from these not so reputable women, prostitutes, women who were creating romantic liaisons for others, matchmakers and pimps. The fourth justification is one that I have sort of analytically drawn from all of this, that seems to me fairly evident in what these monastic authors have to say. They themselves would not phrase it in these terms, mostly, although in some cases they do. And that is, again, what I've mentioned before, the context of the pre-modern India's predominantly patriarchal culture, and specifically the fact that men's honor in these communities was affected by how the women in their communities, in their clans, in their villages, were conducting themselves, specifically in terms of their sexual restraint. Again, harking back to something like Manu, where we find the idea that it is not only for the protection of women that husbands, sons, and fathers guard those women. The men are also doing it for themselves. If they don't do it, who will take them seriously as men? They will be seen as weak men because they are not able to guard and protect the women in their communities. So what I'd like to stress then is that, again, this is not just about the nuns. This is largely about the men themselves and their sense of what constitutes male masculine honor in this cultural context. You had to be able to control the women in your community. It turns out, even if it's a monastic community, it's not restricted to lay families where we have the traditional pater familias overseeing, daughters, sisters, wives, and so forth. But that ideal translated to monastic communities as well. To elaborate a little bit on the points I've just made, here are some of the passages where we see this concern that nuns should not be confused with prostitutes. For example, Gunabrabha's specification in the Vinaya Sutra, again, a nunnery should be inside of a town, but it should not be at a crossroads. The nun should not stand at the nunnery's door, nor at a window. May have something to do with the perception recorded in texts such as the Kama Sutra that apparently women who were standing by the door would be perceived as prostitutes, as women who could be, quote, easily had. This is seen in the Kama Sutra as well as in some other texts of the period. Similarly, for the Jains, there's a specification that nuns have to always travel in groups of three or more, because if there are only two people, if it's an old nun and a young nun, people will start gossiping. Oh, that's she's a prostitute, and this older woman is the bawd, the one who's arranging her liaisons with men. Or it'll be suspected that they are messengers carrying secret messages from one person to another. Again, these sort of suspect characters. So those are associations the monastic community definitely didn't want the nuns to evoke. Therefore, they would have to travel in big groups. They would have to make noise, not be secretive. They would have to be covered well, so there would be no suggestion that they were trying to provoke male sexual interest, and so forth. Let me briefly wrap up in a few minutes, and then we will leave about 15 minutes or so for your questions. I want to come back to this idea, as I said before, that for these monastic communities, given the patriarchal context of pre-modern India, that the male monastic leaders felt themselves to be implicated in how the nuns conducted themselves. In my research, I've discussed this in more detail. I'd like to just close with a quote from the Jain commentary again of Sanghadasa, where he's imagining the lay community as they see the nuns living in a place that is not very well protected. What would they say? And he imagines them saying, "Look, these women who seek refuge in the ascetic's grove dwell in such a contemptible place. What do you think of this kind of dharma? What do you think of this kind of religious tradition?" Thus, there would be censure against the teacher here being the Tirthankara. So we definitely don't want that to happen, that the Tirthankara would be criticized. But notice what comes next. The monks would also be reviled, and wicked people would ridicule those who support them. Those who are headed towards renunciation change their minds, and daughters of good families return home. Because the nuns do a certain thing, because they do not observe the practices of following the rules, of living a proper kind of lodgings, where it is clear to everybody in the community, okay, these are not prostitutes, they're not messengers, they're trying to remain in clothes, they're trying to protect their celibacy, they're not trying to tempt men. If that is not clear to the community, then all kinds of things will happen. And first thing is that the monks will also be subject to criticism. This tells us that the monks could not, even if they wanted to, they could not remain indifferent to how the nuns conducted themselves, because they would always be implicated themselves as the guardians, as the sort of, as the agents, really, on behalf of the nuns. But similarly, the tradition would suffer sort of a public image crisis. People would start ridiculing those who give them support. And as we know, for a renunciant community, material support is what makes it possible. So then what do you do? Not only that, but according to the fearful imagining of Sanghadasa, people who had been planning on renouncing and joining the Jain community, they would change their minds. So the community would not grow and be strengthened. It would, to the contrary, it would be diminished. And lastly, daughters of good families. This is a term evoking a daughter, a sort of a classy woman who'd been intending to join the nuns' community, daughter from a good, reputable, wealthy family. They would change their minds also. They would return home. So if the nuns don't conduct themselves in the proper way, the entire tradition suffers. Monks are criticized, the lay supporters are criticized, and the tradition is not strengthened. So much hinges on this conduct of women. And as I've been trying to illustrate, it is the concern of the men. It is their status and honor that is implicated. So the fear is that outside criticisms, whether it's from the lay people or from members of other communities, will turn into criticisms of the monks who are associated with these nuns, the teachers who have ordained them, and more widely, the very traditions that have permitted them to renounce. Such that for these two Indian traditions that historically, remarkably, allowed women to go forth in monastic orders, would the judgment of the wider world then be that this was a mistake? Women should not be allowed to join these communities. So that may have been one of the fears as well. With that, I think I would like to conclude this part of the talk, and I would like to invite your questions as they come up, if anybody has comments or would like clarifications. It seems we have about 15 minutes. And in the last slide, I simply have some select sources on the history of Jain nuns. Again, I left out bibliography on Buddhist women and Buddhist nuns, knowing that there will be so many more really excellent lectures that have been given and will be given, where you will get a lot of these relevant sources. So with that, I will see if anybody has comments or questions or observations. Seems there's a comment from Venerable Analaya. Who says he does not find it that convincing that this idea of past Tirthankaras having more nuns in their communities, reading that as showing that the Jains are more accommodating is not too convincing, since the hierarchically lower position of Jain nuns seems similar to the Buddhist case. So it remains an enigma to me that the hagiographical tradition would see the Tirthankaras as having more nuns than monks, especially as you have shown the monks were quite nervous about the public image being affected by nuns. If you have any other idea on this issue, I would very much welcome that. Right, so I have similar reservations as well. Again, because the Jain tradition doesn't really elaborate on what does it mean that there were this many thousands of nuns. We cannot really know what the early tradition was thinking of as a justification. And to me, it has even occurred, could it be that there were more nuns because, in a way, a nun counts for less than a single monk? That they, you needed 300,000 nuns to counterbalance 48,000 monks or whatever the case might be. So certainly it's a simplification to argue that because there are these greater numbers of nuns, therefore surely it's a more accommodating tradition. As I've said, when you read between the lines, when you examine what exactly the texts are saying, it's a much more complex issue, and we see we certainly see historical attitudes of that are just as, if not more, biased towards men in as heads of the hierarchy, and the perception that men are the norm. Thank you for that question. Any other thoughts or there's a question from Robert Grosch. Were the numbers of monks and nuns ever really counted and recorded in the Buddhist and the Jain Sanghas? Yes, I wish. To my knowledge, statistically, all that we can know is, for example, there are these studies of looking very closely at inscriptions from sites such as Sanchi or Barhut, and counting how many inscriptions from monks, how many inscriptions from nuns. Apart from these references to the Tirthankaras, until we get to the modern period, to my knowledge, and maybe somebody among the audience will know better, I don't know of statistical accounting for keeping track of how many monks and nuns. Until we come to the present era, and for the Jains, Peter Flügel from SOAS has written on the demographic tendencies in the Jain tradition, and interestingly there we again see in every tradition except for the Digambaras, there are more nuns than monks, and the trend seems to be growing. But sadly, we don't have historical statistics. Thank you. So Anagarika Michelle Raymond is asking, how were Jain rules formulated and codified? Did they evolve and how? Good question. What makes it this tricky is that the formation of the Jain canon, like in the Buddhist canons, was an oral process for so long. And we don't have access to the various revisions or points when exactly they were formulated. And then again, they may be attributed to certain persons, but that may be more of a collective author. So we don't know the prehistory of these layers. But we do know that in the Shvetambara case, by mid-5th century, they had been formulated and codified in what seems to be a set form. Where we see them evolving, to my mind, is in these commentaries, because the monastic rules set an ideal, but they don't really elaborate on, okay, what to do in a situation when there's some special situation that the rules just don't account for. So there we see these monastic interpreters of later times saying, oh, we need to take that into consideration and articulating some exception. Okay, in these special circumstances, then you may be allowed to do X. Or given that Jainism is a minority tradition in our time and we really just need to survive, we can be more flexible about this or that issue. So that's where we see them evolving in time, in the context of real issues. Dharma Ocean sends a question. I have been told that Jain's Bhikkhuni order was established earlier than that of Buddhism. Is that correct? What is the textual evidence? Very good. So again, what makes this a little bit tricky is that traditionally, if you look at what the Jain tradition has to say about itself, is that, again, nuns were present from the earliest time onwards. Even the community of Tirthankara Rishabha, who lived eons ago, there were nuns. There were 300,000 nuns. How can we ever verify that? So the question of coming from inside the tradition or versus coming from a sort of critically historical perspective. And coming from the latter perspective as a textual scholar can only speak at best about the period of the last two Tirthankaras at best, those of Parshva and Mahavira. And in case of Mahavira, it is simply the case that it seems that the nuns were always there in his community. Like the Buddhist community was headed by Mahaprajapati Gautami, the Buddha's aunt and foster mother, the Jain nuns community was headed by a woman named Chandana, the nun Chandana. But there's no such dramatic story of the community's founding. So what's the textual evidence? Again, we have only these canonical descriptions. We don't have inscriptional evidence from this time. So it's a very complex question. When exactly when they found it, I don't have that answer in terms of the exact point in time. Maitri Sara Bobbitt has a question. Is there any text or commentary which says how Jain or Buddhist nuns felt about the rules that applied to them? That's a great question. And I wish I had such a secret manuscript in hand where they finally give their take on things. Apart from texts such as the Buddhist Terigatha, which are poems attributed to nuns, although it's debated whether they were in fact authored by women. So that's one instance where we see at least a female perspective, a literary perspective, sort of articulating what it was like to be a female renouncer at this time. Otherwise, until you come to the modern period, we really have to, what I have tried to do is practice, hopefully not too irresponsibly, some kind of reading between the lines in the existing texts that we have, which again are authored by male authors, that is true. But if reading closely, it is possible sometimes to tease out some of the things they seem to have been responding to. And in some cases, you can imagine or even attribute some of those responses to the women in their communities, because that was part of their context. We know that there were real historical women who were nuns during the time of these commentators. So sometimes, and in my dissertation and book project, I've tried to do a couple of case studies like this, where we see, for example, the commentators anticipating certain kind of criticism or saying, if the nuns complain X, Y, and Z in these ways, oh, that these rules are unfair, this is how you respond to them, or these are the penalties you assign to them. And to me, that suggests that possibly these were complaints or criticisms that these authors would have heard from real-time, real-living nuns. Either that, or they were anticipating in the sense that that maybe, you know, we too sense there's a disparity here and have to be on the defensive in case objections, in case complaints come up. But again, so there are these possibilities. It's a sort of limited perspective, just because we are looking at things through the lens of male authors, which is unfortunate. I think we have time for one more question from Anagarika Michelle Raymond. How is it that Jainism was able to withstand the times that caused the loss of Buddhism in India? Were they equally targeted? Might the larger number of nuns make them less of a target, being less of a threat? Good question, and a really big question. I think it's still, we haven't exactly resolved what caused Buddhism to, quote, disappear in India. We know that it was a gradual process, but it is interesting given that these two traditions have been so interlinked. So, you know, some of the more compelling suggestions we have from scholars such as Padmanabh Jaini is that the Jains were able to, in ways that worked for them, ways to sort of define themselves in contradistinction to others just enough to retain their sectarian identity, but not too much that they were perceived as a threat. And the Jain authors of the time I'm looking at, they're constantly afraid of extinction, of being harassed and being sent into exile by kings. So they were certainly worried about this. It seems they were always, or certainly by the time of early medieval period, they were a minority and perhaps therefore not perceived as an enormous threat, perhaps not receiving such lavish donations as some of the biggest, most famous Buddhist commentaries. So my hunch is, and again, not knowing fully what happened, is that they were able to navigate that, not being too threatening, not being too powerful, but still being flexible enough that they could maintain their sectarian identity without being engulfed and just morphing into some Hindu sect, for example. Whether the larger number of nuns made them less of a target, perhaps. I would imagine having many, many nuns would, on the contrary, make them more subject to criticism. I think all of these questions are pointing us to where the research still needs to go, issues that we still don't know that well yet. And in that, I'm inviting you all's collaboration and continued research on the part of all of us. So thank you for your questions. And I think with this, I will conclude and turn it back over to Venerable Analaya. Thank you so much to everyone who could join us and for your attention. And have a good day.
Okay, recording is off.